It changed halfway through after he might have attempted to murder the last one with a bit of falling roof, but that's a different story. Basically, I just want to make sure that things in this school are right for the students in it. At the moment, one of the things that I want to do is make sure that there's communication between the class reps in every year. One of the things that I've discovered on the way through is that lots of the same problems happen every year, and we don't really know because we don't know what happened the year before. So I want to make sure that class reps are able to just leave a little report on what happened in their year for the next year, so you'll be able to find out if it's happening the same as it happened last year. You'll be able to get it sorted much more easily. Also, things like just the computer labs upstairs. When you get into later years, you'll discover that it's really hard to actually find a space that you can sit in for a whole day. Stuff like that, just want to work on that sort of thing. So if you can vote for me, I've got loads of experience, know lots of people within the school, and hopefully you'll be seeing me again over the year. Thanks a lot. Oh, sorry, it's Andrew Burney for School Rep. Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew. Actually, he does know a lot of people in this school. I know Andrew quite well. Right. Wait a moment while I fasten up this gizmo. Okay, folks, so thanks again for turning up. This time what I want to talk about is, it's a little bit different. In some ways, it's edging towards what we'll get onto later, talking about state and finite state machines and that sort of thing. But we're still now in the world of logic, right? So I'll be talking a little bit about protocols and protocol analysis. So the problem that we'll be looking at is a particular type of protocol, and we'll be going through that. But the bit that you need to understand before we do that is how you can take logic and use it to talk about states of the world. So why might you want to do that? You might want to do that because, you know, pretty much everything that you want to describe that that has some sort of dynamics to it will have some sort of state. So there's a state to what I'm doing now. Currently, what I'm doing is I'm giving you the lecture. Probably in about an hour from now, there'll be some other state that I'm in, which is to do with maybe preparing a research grant that I'm working on. It's probably the next thing I'll do, and so on. If you're working with individual devices like laptops or mobile phones or that sort of thing, then there's also a notion of state. It's usually a much more precise notion of state, the particular state that particular device is in. And so that reasoning about that sort of stuff has been a big feature of computer systems engineering pretty much from when it started. Even for individual isolated devices, that's been very important. And it's become a lot more important now once we start to move into systems where we have lots of mobile devices. So you have the state of your device. You also have the state of the world. For example, you're carrying your mobile phone, and you move around from place to place, and you're in a lecture, and then you're on a bus, and then you're maybe on a train, or maybe you go into an airport, and you get on an airplane. And as you do that, the state of your device changes, the environment that it's in changes, and you want somehow to maintain all of these things in parity. So the things that your device is able to do when you're on an airplane is typically different from the sort of things that it's able to do when you're in the airport, and maybe a different again from what you were doing when you were on the train or whatever. So all of these things change. It's very complicated because many aspects of state interact, and you somehow want to be able to keep a handle on all of those things. And one of the things that makes modern systems quite difficult to engineer is all of that complexity, just understanding how the states of everything changes as you build your system. And your system somehow has to be resistant to that. And many systems, you know, there are bugs, and they're not quite as resistant as you thought. So an awful lot of the time that's spent in systems engineering, if you ever go on to become a systems engineer of some kind, actually building systems that are deployed, then if they're of any significant size or complexity, then it's quite likely that either you or somebody else that you're working with will be thinking about this kind of problem, because it's unavoidable. Okay. But we're talking about logic. So thing about logic is there isn't, as you will have noticed, some of you will be going, what's he talking about? Because logic doesn't really have state. You know, when you're writing down things in your propositional logic, they're just true, right? So if you do something, if you're doing a sequent calculus proof, you write down your set of axioms, and then you prove something from the set of axioms, you're just proving stuff. It's always true if you believe the axioms. There's no state. That's kind of the huge advantage of logic. There is no state. It's just true or it's false. And that's wonderful, but there's no state in it. So then you have to find some way of getting state into logic. And I'll give you one way of doing that. It's not the only way. There's a huge amount of research and literature and actually engineering science with different ways of doing this. I'm just going to give you a kind of elementary one. And then we'll talk about a banking protocol. So here's the usual story. I'll give you a problem to start you off. So imagine that you're working for a bank and you're pushing out cash line machines. Okay, so everybody knows how to use a cash line machine, and you have a protocol for dealing with that. So this protocol says there are three different types of entities in this protocol. There's the customer, that's you, let's say. There's the branch. So that's the bit. Branch, in this particular protocol, branch basically means anything that can give you out money. So it could be a cash line machine. It could be maybe, I guess it could be something on the internet. It could be a person giving you out money. So anything can actually hand over the cash. So that's what I mean by a branch. And there's the bank. What I mean by the bank is the somewhere centrally with whatever is the information about how much cash that you've actually got, your account, whatever it is that's holding your account details. Of course, now in the good old days, the distinction between branches and banks and so on was very, very clear because there wasn't much computation involved, nothing much was networked, and so if you wanted the Bank of Scotland was the building up on the mound, and the branches were the physical branches around about. And reconciliation was done by I actually don't know carrier pigeon, horse and pony, whatever it was. But it wasn't computer. Now, of course, these things are a little bit more nebulous, and what your actual bank might be and where it might be, you don't know. It could be distributed. So anyway, there's some entity that has responsibility for your funds. That has the gold copy of how much cash you've got. Think about it that way. There's the branch that's involved in distributing it. Can be many branches. And there's lots of customers. And then what the protocol says, a customer is allowed to ask to buy money from a branch. And the branch is allowed to sell money to the customer. That's the protocol there. And I'll give you a moment the protocol. Okay, so the protocol is going to say how this gets done. And the bank is allowed to reconcile a transaction done by the branch. The branch says, I'll give this person 50 quid. And then you have to reconcile it with the branch. So the branch is able to keep your account up to date properly. You want this to be consistent. The branch can also check funds because it doesn't want to be able to give you 50 quid unless you've actually got 50 quid in your account. And the bank can pass back a message that you do indeed have funds, right? Okay. In this protocol, I'm not going to actually be working with the amounts here. So just to make it simple, we'll not talk about the actual amount here. So you can say have funds just means you've got a cash. Okay. So here's a little protocol. It's bristling with notation that you haven't seen before. So don't worry. I'm not going to ask you to remember this notation, because all I want to do is to give you the notion of what a protocol is like. It's not important for this course that you understand this notation. Okay. So this particular notation I like because I invented it. It's what I use for the protocols that I use in my research. So actually, I do quite a bit of work with these sorts of protocols in peer-to-peer systems, distributing knowledge. So this is kind of my thing. So I'm afraid I'm inflicting this on you. That's the bad news. Good news is you don't have to remember it, so that's okay. But the more practical reason why I'm using it is because it's a very, very simple at some level simple language for representing a protocol. These are the three roles. So here's a customer, here's the role for the customer, here's the role for the branch, and here's the role for the bank. These roles just say what it is you're allowed to do, which is what protocols typically specify. Okay, so this This arrow here is a message going out. So all the communication is by message passing. This is a message going out. If it goes to the right, it's a message going out. This is the content of the message, and this is the role of the entity that's receiving the message. Don't worry about this A thing. It's just saying that this B is a branch. This is a message coming in to the peer in this role. So this is saying this is from the branch. The same branch is saying sell. Okay, and you can have recursion in these things. You've had recursion already in functional programming, right? You know what recursion is. So these can be recursively defined. So let me take you through one of these roles so you know what it is. So what this is saying intuitively is a customer, anybody who's a customer C, can send a message out saying I want to buy to some branch B, and then, so then is sequence, the next thing that happens is it gets a message back saying I'll sell you some money from the branch, and then it becomes a customer again. So then you can send more messages, so it recurses. So this is like a little loop where you're saying buy, sell, can do that. Okay? And if this doesn't happen, it breaks the protocol. So you can't, this is what you're allowed to do in the protocol. This one says, let me just go through it just in English. This one says if you're a branch, you can receive a message saying I want to buy some money from a customer. So that corresponds to this one. This is the message going out. This is the message coming in. And then I send out a message checking the funds for that customer to the bank. So that's this bit. And then the bank has to say it's got funds. So that's this bit. Back it comes. And then you can say, I'll sell you the money. And then you reconcile with the bank, so the bank knows that you handed over the cash. And then you can be a branch again. Right? Okay, so that turns through there. So, and then what the bank can do is, this OR is choice. So this says, the bank says, if the bank gets a request to check for funds, so there's two possibilities. For a bank. Either you get a request to check for funds from the branch, and then you say, yep, got funds, or you get a reconcile request from the branch. You do whatever you do internally. And then you're a bank again. Right? Okay. So the only real reason for giving you all of this notation is just to show you that you can write down this kind of protocol reasonably succinctly and quite precisely. I could just have given you this diagram and said, a customer can request, can ask to buy something from the branch, and then the branch can sell to the customer. And the branch can receive a request for a buy, and then it has to check funds, and then it has to get a message back saying there is funds, and then it can sell to the customer, and then it must reconcile with the bank. And then a bank can receive a request to check funds, and then it says it has funds to the branch, or it can get a reconcile request. Okay. And of course, the protocol could be more complicated than that. It could have all sorts of other choices for what happens when something doesn't happen, and then what do you do, and so on. But for now, let's take the simplest possible protocol, which just breaks when there are things that don't quite fit. Okay? Happy with that. You understand? So now, the important thing is you understand what I mean by a protocol, which is something that tells you what the sequence of message passing is supposed to be for a particular type of behavior. That's what this does. And you understand what this bank protocol says. You don't even need to know the notation. You need to know intuitively what it says. Happy with all of that. You can hold that in your mind for when we come to the end. So the thing is, we want to be able to take protocol type information like this, and we want to be able to bring that into our logics, which My logic doesn't have any of this sort of sequence type stuff in it, and we want to be able to talk about these temporal sequences of events that happen in time. So what I want to be able to do is to take a protocol like this, and I want to be able to say, if I saw certain things happening, what is it that I could then prove about the system? This happens, then this happens, then this happens, then this happens. What then is true? Right. And so what I'm going to do is this. I think it's the simplest possible trick that you can do with the logic to get this to happen. And there are lots of other tricks that you can do, but I'm just going to give you one. And the trick hinges on thinking about state sequences. So instead of having a bunch of expressions that are in a set in my sequence, I'm going to put an ordering on them, and it's going to be a temporal ordering. So imagine I have a sequence like this. Here's a sequence. This is Dave's life. Dave wakes up, and then he reads mail, and then he gives a lecture, and then he reads mail, and then he goes home, and then he sleeps, and that's it, right? So that's the sequence. So it's a bit different from saying this is true about Dave, right? So this is not the same as saying it is true that Dave sleeps. Okay, but it's not, because this is giving you more information. It's saying that Dave sleeps after he goes home, right? Not just at any arbitrary time. So we're putting putting an ordering on the events of things, and that ordering is a temporal significance. There are lots of other orderings that you can use that aren't just temporal. So actually, in some ways, I don't really want to get into this, but a temporal modality is just one kind of modality that you can give to a logic. You can have lots of other modalities to do with beliefs or possibilities and so on. And as you start to explore those modalities in logic, you end up in rather different families of logic. So that's a kind of, that's one of the interesting things that you'll find if you explore this a little more. So anyway, I'm going to invent a predicate here, which is called access. And access, if I say access JSF, it means that F is true in the jth state in S, and the j counting from the beginning. So if I say access 2SF, then I go 1, 2, reads mail, Dave is access 2 in, here's S, F, right? All that we're doing is access just gives me an index onto this sequence. And I count from the beginning. Index number 1 is here. Here's 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And access just allows me to count along that sequence. It's not doing anything clever. Okay? Happy with that, because if you don't understand that, you get... There's nothing, nothing up my sleeve. That's all it's doing. It's just counting along.
Mm-hmm. A typical state sequence counts from 1, not from 0?
In the way I've set it up, yes. It doesn't really matter, but from I'm doing it that way. Okay, all you need is some ordering. It doesn't really matter how you're doing the counting. Okay? Okay, so now here's where we take advantage of this. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to change, remember, the good old-fashioned familiar sequence calculus rules. So if you've been paying attention on sequence calculus stuff, you're in good shape. Because all I've done is change, remember in the previous lectures I've always had this kind of undifferentiated, I think I called it F. It was this green thing, and it was just the set of axioms we were dealing with. Okay, so what I'm going to do is make this just a tiny bit more sophisticated. And S is now going to be a sequence, one of these temporally ordered sequences. And J is going to be the index. So it's a bit like instead of having a proof where I say I'm doing my proof and all of the axioms are pertinent. Now what I do is I say I'm doing my proof and I'm going to index the steps I take in my proof with respect to the particular position I'm at in the temporal sequence. So I have, so S is the sequence, for example that one, or whatever I want to express, any set of expressions, ordered set of expressions. J is the point that I'm at in the sequence. Okay, so now let me go through and give you the proof rules. A lot of them are really quite familiar. Here's the one that's kind of at the business end. So remember, in the sequence calculus, you typically have at least one proof rule that's giving you kind of almost trivially the proof. Here it is here. So if I want to, given a sequence and some particular identifier, if I want to prove something from it, A here, then I can do that if I can access at the jth position in S the expression that I'm going to use. And then from that expression, I can prove A. Actually, that could be, if I want, using the sequence calculus proofs that I used in my old, in the ones that you've seen before. So whatever proof system I want to use for that. Okay, so all this is really saying is, if I want to prove at index J, A, given S, I need to be able to access whatever is true at S. That's what access is doing. It says, what's true at this point? And now let's prove it directly from that. And that proof has no temporal modality. It's just whatever is true given what I now what I know at this point, right? That's straightforward. These ones are then just doing the unpacking. So this for the different connectives. So if I want to prove A and B, then I prove it independently for A and B. It's not really much different from what you've seen before, actually. If it's A or B at J, then I can either prove A or I can prove B. There's nothing different here from before. The only slight wrinkle is that this is the same J, right? If I want to prove A and B at point J, I prove A at point J and B also at point J. Right, so it's the same time point. Similarly here, the J is the same. And I'm just using closed world negation here because that's what I decided I was going to do just to make it nice and simple. So if I so this is just the same as before. The only difference is that I have this slightly more complicated structure. So actually, it's not so bad, right? All I've really done is give you exactly the sequence proofs that I gave you before. I've given you a slightly more complicated representation of the axiom set that you're going to use to do the proof. And that axiom set has this index that enables me to talk about the ordering of the information that I'm using. Okay. Now it gets a little bit more complicated because this is the bit that allows me to, I'm standing at a particular point in time. Time t is 3 or something, that's the time. And I can say, what can I prove at this particular time point? But none of those rules allow me to look forward or look backwards. I could just do it at a particular time, which is kind of limiting, right? What's true at this point? But I want to be able to say, if I'm standing at this point, what's true in the future? What's true in the immediate future? What's true at some point in the future? And I want to be able to look back. I want to be able to say, what's true in the past? Right? So those are the ones that we'll deal with here. So then I have to introduce a few more bits of terminology. So next, I'm going to take to be the next point in time. Previous, I'm going to take to be the immediately previous point in time. E-future is going to be at some time in the future. E-past is at some time in the past. A-future is at all times in the future. And A-past is at all times in the past. Right? So I'm standing at a particular time point. And I want to be able to say, that's the future, that's the past. I want to be able to say, immediately before this happened, what happened? Or immediately after this happened, what will happen? Or I want to be able to say, at some point in the past, did this happen? Or I want to say, did this happen at all times previous to where I currently am? Or looking to the future, I want to be able to say, you know, at some time in the future is this going to happen? Or I want to be able to say, will this be true at all points in the future? These actually are oh, yeah, question.
In the part of the statement, mm-hmm. A-past, is that the title, the right part, or B? Twice
the name? That is a typo. Congratulations. but it's good you pointed out. Yes, where was I? Oh, yes, so... So why am I wittering on about all of these funny distinctions? Is this just am I just saying this because it's the first thing that I thought of and it's quite nice to talk about the future and the past and so on, I can get the logics to work. This matters a lot if you're actually designing systems to be able to talk about those kinds of things. Because imagine you're building some kind of system. Let's say what you're doing is you're building some system where it's a really serious system and you're worried about, I don't know, the safety of the system or something like that. And you build your structure, and you start. And because you're so very concerned that it works very well, you build a formal specification of what it is that system will do. And later on, we'll talk about finite state machines and those sorts of ways of representing what the system does. And then, what you're very interested in doing is being able to show that certain behaviors will or will not hold. You might be interested, for example, in a proof to show that. At some future time, your system would have some beneficial behavior. At some future time, this useful behavior will happen. Or conversely, you might want to be able to show, at no future time will this pathological behavior happen. And you really care that for that system, you can show that property. Then you're going to want to have languages that can reason about that. and you're going to want to have probably automated methods for being able to do that kind of analysis. Okay, so it's these sort of things are practical things, not just abstract ideas and logic. Okay, so let me go through these. I mean, you know, you've already been looking at them and checking them as I've been talking. So for next, immediately future point in time, then if I want to know that at the next point in time A is true, given that I'm at this particular int, J is where I'm currently at. I'm positioned on the timeline there. Then is it true at the next time point A is true? Then I can prove that if I can prove A at J plus 1. All I do is increment the counter and then prove it then. Right? So if this was if J was time 2, then all I do is find out whether A is true at time 3. Straightforward. Then looking backwards, I do the following. I go backwards. So I have this very, there's lots of different ways of doing the ordering. So this is just the simplest, easiest one to explain. The ordering is just, you know, going back through the ordering on the numbers. Okay, so that's it for the immediate one. I can go one back or one forward by using those proof rules. Then if I want to say at some future time, then what I need to show is, and I've got J, so then I need to show that I can prove A for K, where K is larger than J, just for some K. So I want, for some K, I want to find some number for K that's larger than J, where I can do this proof. So for example, if J was 2, then this is the future, then K has to be larger than 2. Similarly, looking back, K has to be smaller than whatever. And then for all future times, then what I have to do is to show that, again, I know J, and I have to show that A is true for every K that's larger than J. Right. And so obviously this could be, this is going to be a very inefficient thing to do if I have a large number of time points to consider. So there's all sorts of things that you can do to try to cope with that complexity, and we're not going to get onto them here. I mean, there's just a tremendous amount of work trying to tame those kinds of problems so that you get the search space right and so on. But that's the basic idea. Happy with all of that. We're just chasing up and down the timeline using the indexes to know which subsets of those axioms we're going to be looking at and which are relevant. That's the only trick I'm really showing you with this. All the rest is just normal sequence calculus proof. Okay? Happy? Okay, so let's do one. So here's a proof. Here's the sequence that I started with, and I want to be able to show, I didn't put it down here, but it's starting at time 1, let's say, that Dave wakes up and at some future time he sleeps, which is kind of obvious. So this is an obvious, you can look at it and you can see it's obviously true, right? There's Dave waking up and later he sleeps. So all I'm really doing for this one is just showing you, the mechanics of this. This should be straightforward for you. Okay, so here's the proof. So I want to be able to show, given S, and S is this, which is ordered. So I want to show an S time 1, this is true. And so then remember the and, I haven't shown, it'd be nice if I had another screen with the proof rules, but remember the proof rule for and, I have to show with the same index the different components of the conjunction. So I want to show at S1, Dave wakes up, and I want to show at S1, some future time Dave sleeps. So then, first bit of it, for S1, Dave wakes up, and I'm going to use the proof rule where I say, if I can access at point number 1 in S, Dave wakes up, which I can, look, there it is. And then I want to show from Dave wakes up that Dave wakes up, which is true, right? And then I do need to do the second part. So from S1, I want to show that at some future time, Dave sleeps. And for that, I need to show that for S.6, this is filling in too much. I'm giving you the answer here, actually. I could show you more detail. But what I want to be able to show is that for some, this would be, for some k, where k is greater than 1, Dave sleeps, right? Sorry, I haven't shown you the workings for that. But 6 would be an instance for k such that sleeps Dave is true at 6, which it is, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, right? Happy with that? I don't need to explain to you. You could try, we could try all of the positions greater than 1 and see whether for any of them we could establish Dave sleeps. So I'm just giving you the answer there, right? And all I need is 1 of these to be true because it's for some future time. Okay?
Could the series be kind of considered like a cycle? For example, if you're at position 4, would you ever say that for some future he gives a lecture? Like the next day?
Position 4. Oh, I see where you have cyclical time. So this is a good question. It's a good question, but sort of I don't want to answer it because it starts to get quite complicated because I've been really kind of fast and loose about how I represent. Well, not fast and loose. I've given you the world's simplest representation of a time sequence, which is you have a bounded set and you go from start to the beginning. His point is really the situation I'm describing is kind of cyclical because this isn't just a fixed set and it only goes to 6. In fact, it goes... after this happens, because my life is so monotonous, there's another 6 and another 6, and it just cycles around for God, that sounds terribly poor. At some point, something nice happens, but potentially it cycles around just forever doing that. At which point, then we have to be able to accommodate that, and I haven't in what I've done. It's a good question because in real life it gets even more complicated than that because time can do funny things. Time doesn't have to be a sequence. Time can branch, for example. You can have things that occur in parallel. It isn't necessarily just a strict sequence. And then we start, and then I could offer you, well, maybe not me, but somebody who is more into that than I am, perhaps, could offer you, you know, entire courses on this kind of thing. Because then you have to have proofs that deal with the fact that you have concurrency, things happening in parallel, or that time branches, and all of these things also interact. So there's whole families of logic that talk about this kind of thing. And the one I'm giving you is the world's simplest. It's bounded, it's sequential, it's only meaningful to talk about things from beginning to end. You can do the exhaustive search on the whole thing, and you can't talk about things happening in parallel. Things can only happen kind of immediately afterwards. So it's a gross simplification. But I don't want to go much beyond that. But the world is a lot more complicated than that, and so are the logical tools for reasoning about it. And there's a very strong interaction with the finite state machine stuff we do, which I'll come back onto at the very end of the course. Sorry, that was a much longer answer than anybody wanted, I'm sure. But you can tell I like this stuff. It's interesting. So. Onto the solution for the banking protocol one, okay. This is another bit that it's not necessarily for you to memorize. It's just what I want to do is to give you a kind of feel for what people do when they're tackling these kinds of problems, so that you know what it's like to be somebody working with logic for these things. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to talk about the problem in a way that we can represent as temporal sequences, because I've got my simple little logic. It's what I've got for solving the problem. I want to try and make some progress in understanding the problem using just that, the world's simplest temporal logic. And then what we're going to do is think of situations that could be problematic and express those as properties. So what I do is I say, okay, how am I going to get my temporal sequences from my protocol? First step, I have this protocol that's talking about what the bank does. And let's assume that that's correct. Okay, so I've done a lot of analysis as a systems engineer. I've gone and talked to lots of people in the bank. I've understood the systems, and I know what the protocol is. I define it in the way I gave at the very beginning, using that fancy notation that I like so much. Then what I'm going to do, first step is, now I've got my logic that I've given to you that enables me to reason about temporal sequences. Right? So now I have a bit of machinery that I can use to analyze that protocol, and you know what it is now. And then, in order to do that, I have to be able to express the sequences that can be derived from my protocol. So in a moment, I'll be talking about that. Then I'm in the position to start reasoning about what's true or false about the protocol. What does that protocol imply logically? But I'm still not finished because as a systems engineer, I have to give it something to prove. Okay, what is it that I want to prove about that thing? That's an intuitive step. So I need to think, so I suppose I'm worried about pathological properties of the protocol. I need to think, what might those be? It's quite hard to infer those, actually, most of the time. Sometimes you can, but quite often, as a systems engineer, you're thinking, what could go wrong? I suppose it's a safety critical system. You're thinking, what could possibly harm people with this system? And a lot of that comes down to experience and intuition and modeling, just like representing the original problem did. And then I use all my mechanisms to do the analysis. Okay? So this is what we're going to do now. So the first thing is to get the message sequence. And to do that, I'm going to give you one more simple protocol. The only reason for giving you this protocol is it's the simplest one I could think to describe, because I just want to show you how to extract the sequence. And it's straightforward. There's actually nothing complicated here. Actually, it could be a lot more complicated, but I'm making it simple. So here's a little protocol, and all it does is, I've called it a gossip protocol. All it does is you have two entities in the protocol. There's this gossip that's going to push out messages, and then there's this very patient listener, and all the listener does is say, go on, go on. It's just like imagine it's you and somebody else who's really very boring, and all you do is you absorb whatever it is they tell you, and you say, go on, go on, and that's it. So here's what the gossip does. The gossip says, I'll tell you something to the listener, and then they're expecting to get a go on from the listener, and then you continue to gossip. And then the listener waits for a tell, and then says, go on, and as listener. And this is just going to roll along, right? So you go on, tell, go on, tell, go on. And that's how it works. Right? That's how that works. Of course, that could generate lots and lots of sequences. And just like you were saying, that one can roll and roll and roll. Here's one sequence that it can generate. It can generate multiple sequences, actually an infinite number of sequences. But here's one. So tell goes out to the listener. So I'll write this as message. So I have a structure called message. And here's a message from the gossip saying tell goes out to the listener, L1. OK, happy with that? So all I'm doing really is rolling through the protocol and exploring what it does. And every time it gives me a behavior, I can write down the sequence. And that sequence is going to be the one, each of those sequences I could pass to my theorem prover, my system that's going to reason about it. Right? So there's a message come out of there. So that's the first thing that happens. And then you can see probably the next thing that will happen, it'll get picked up there. So then there's a message that's received by the listener. That's a message going out from that guy saying this to the listener. This is a message received by the listener that came from the gossip. So they're kind of symmetrical, these things. The next thing that can happen is the listener says, go on. That's where that came from, going out to the gossip. And the gossip gets that. So that's like a complete cycle through that protocol. And that could generate you another one. That's another complete cycle that would be exactly the same for at the end, and so on and so on and so on. It rolls. Okay. And each one of these sequences that I can generate is a correct behavior of the system, right? So if you observe this, then that's consistent with the protocol. And if you observed another one that was like this and was 8 long, it would be consistent with the protocol. Okay, so I could potentially generate all of the sequences. Like this runs for infinitely amounts of time, I could generate all of the sequences. If I was clever, I could probably trim that down to a very small number of interesting sequences. And there are various ways of being clever about spotting what the interesting sequences are and the ones where actually you've got no more information from them because it's just recursion and doing the same thing again. Okay? So if I can do that from my protocol, then I can at least generate interesting sequences. Now, if I have the right kinds of protocols, I can be sure I've generated all of them. Okay, but we're not going to go into that. Okay, and now I'm just going to use the machinery. Right? I want to be able to access states in the sequence. Here's my sequence. And I just use access as before. So this is exactly what you saw before. And so, for example, if I said access at point 2 in SF, then F would be this guy. Right, because that's the second one along. So all of that machinery now works because I got the sequence in the right form. Happy about that? This is just machinery. So all I've described you so far is just machinery. It just rolls. here's one from a banking protocol, so I'm just going to give you this sequence. And you just have to trust me that I can generate that from the banking protocol, because there's no time to go through that big long protocol and say, here's where that comes from and here's where that comes from. Here's a sequence. You can go back and do it if you want, because you've got the slides and you can check. But if you look through that protocol, you'll see that you can get a message that goes out saying bye for a branch. Then that gets picked up by the branch. And then the branch asks the bank to check funds. The bank receives that. So X1 is the bank, C1 is the customer, B1 is a branch. Bank check funds. The bank says, yeah, it's got funds. That gets back to the branch. The branch then says, I'll sell you the money. That's received by the customer, and the branch reconciles with the bank. Bingo. So that's a sequence that works. And you could generate lots of different sequences off that protocol, right? Okay, happy with that? Got the banking protocol, which you can kind of remember. You got on your notes. You can generate sequences from that. We have our theorem prover. We're kind of getting there, but we're missing the bit where what are the properties that we'd like to check? Okay, so here's an undesirable temporal property. We don't want to see this in our banking system, probably. So what this says is a customer is offered money by branch B1. So imagine there's two branches now, branch B1 and branch B2, because banks have lots of branches, lots of ways you can get cash. And there's some customer C, and here's my bank, X1. So customer is offered money by branch B1, and subsequently, some future point, that customer is offered money by branch B2. And subsequent to that, branch B1 reconciles with the bank, and so does B2 immediately afterwards. I can't, in my language, some languages you can, but in the language I've given you, I can't say simultaneously. So the best I can do is to say immediately afterwards. So nothing could have intervened. So you get this reconciliation immediately afterwards. Let me show you it pictorially. So here's the customer. Oh, sorry. Let me show you as this first. Here's it expressed as something to prove. So this says, here's branch B1 saying sell to the customer. And then at some future time, a message saying sell goes to the customer from branch B2. And at some future time from that, these two simultaneous messages to reconcile go into the bank. Now let me show you it pictorially. So there's the sell, comes in from branch B1, there it is. And then at some future time, that comes in to sell from B2. And then, as near as damn it simultaneously, with nothing happening in between, those two guys happen, right? Why is that bad? Because if that happens, then if I'm a customer and I'm fast enough off the mark and I want to overdraw in my bank account without getting any particular permission from the bank, all I need to do is be able to get those two guys to sell to me before they then jointly reconcile. Right? So the idea, the scam is basically, it's not necessarily a scam, I don't need to deliberately exploit this, it could just happen, is that suppose my account has £100 in it, and I actually want to draw out £200, but the bank wouldn't allow me to do that, then what this says is I get convince this guy to sell me £100 and this guy to sell me £100 close enough together that these guys haven't done the reconciliation with the bank until too late. Right, so they're reconciled simultaneously. Okay, this is probably no longer true. I have no idea, but it used to be true that you could do this. Right, so you could because you're relying on the fact that this branch here is doing a reconciliation independently with this, and the protocol that I've got doesn't say that this guy has to lock all the other reconciliations before you give the go-ahead here. So this guy can get the go-ahead to sell before this guy has done the reconciliation. Right? Happy with that? That's That would be an undesirable thing. Well, depending on your point of view, actually. I mean, that would be an undesirable thing. So in general, if it could go to with vast sums of money, that would be a pretty undesirable thing, right? Because it would mean that basically this guy didn't necessarily have a consistent picture of what your account was. And there's all sorts of arguments you might make about whether or not it's desirable in a banking system, because these guys have to operate fast, right? It's no good having a hole-in-the-wall a bank teller or even an internet bank teller if you can't get the cash like that, because then nobody's going to use it. On the other hand, you do want to be able to make sure that you can't do this thing where money's being given out without really knowing what the true story is back at the bank. And it is a distributed system. That's the way modern banking systems work, of course. Okay? So this, convinced that that's a pathological behavior. Well, it's pathological, maybe not in a clear-cut sense, because you might tolerate some element of this in a system, but essentially a pathological case. So then, so then you have to trust me again. I'm just going to give it to you in the interest of time. If you take the protocol that I give you, you go away and work it out. You can check. You've got the notes. You go through the protocol, and you can generate this sequence. Okay? And you're meant to look at that and go, oh my God, how am I going to understand that? That's exactly the reason why you need to be able to do this kind of mechanical checking, because from almost any protocol that you can think of that has any degree of possibility to have asynchrony in it or alternative temporal sequences, then it's nearly impossible for the human mind to just look at the protocol and figure out, is this correct or is it not? Will this have no pathological behaviors? Forget it. It's nearly impossible to do it just looking at it, unless you're a genius. Hmm? Oh, pathological in this case is this. So pathological means this property, which you agree is you don't want, right?
Yeah.
Holds of this sequence, which you're just going to have to trust me, and you can check, you can derive from the protocol, right? So if this is a sequence which I can get legitimately from the protocol I gave you, which I can, go and check it. You can check that by hand, right? And if you agree that this is a pathological protocol, right, then I'm not going to show you the proof tree because it's too cumbersome to draw. But I can then show you that in that sequence, there we go, sorry. Here's a message coming in from branch B1 to cell. Subsequently, going further through the sequence. You can do the proof by hand if you really want to back home. But subsequently, there's branch B2 saying sell to the same customer. And in future, here's two essentially simultaneous, one immediately after the other, messages reconciling for C1 to the bank, which is exactly this property. So here's the message, sell to B1, at some future time, sell to B2, and then these two reconciliations immediately afterwards. It's there, and it's in the sequence. So if I believe that's a pathological property, you could argue whether or not it really is, and many banking systems actually tolerate this problem, then I have a problem. Oh yes, sorry. My usage of English. I've spent too much time in a university, so I sometimes use flowery language. I mean bad. Okay, so that's it. That's the end of the example. Here are some technical things that you might want to revise now, and this is not particularly for this lecture. I just want to give you a little bit of advice. We're probably this year I'm a little bit ahead of the tutorials because the tutorials got set back by about a week. So that's fine. Actually, it's probably quite good because it means you're seeing this in plenty of time for the tutorials. So it's still a good idea to start looking at how to express English sentences. Don't worry too much about the quantification, but it is nice if you want to try doing that. Tautology and inconsistency, truth table stuff. And have a go at the proof rules. Do have a go by now, I'd say. So, great. Thanks very much, and see you next time.